You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job posts seen on other job sites. With Indeed sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/kidsandfamily. Just go to Indeed.com/kidsandfamily right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need. You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job posts seen on other job sites. With Indeed sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/kidsandfamily. Just go to Indeed.com/kidsandfamily right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.
Astonishing Legends Network.
All right, everybody, welcome back. So glad to have you back. So glad to be back. I hope your holidays were delightful and getting back into work isn't too excruciating. We'll get through it together. I'll help you out. That's what I'm here for. I got to tell you, I just had a phone call with the legendary Tess Feifel, my associate executive producer. You know her from Astonishing Legends. Oh my God, she is the best. My God. Tess Feifel, you are a superstar. We're making big plans for the podcast in 2025. We're going to build RHPB into a semi-towering, mid-sized podcast that's still super personal and, frankly, not for everyone. But if you do love the show and you do want to help support us, please do rate and review the show on whatever platform you listen. Give us a review. I love reading them. And you know what? To borrow the words of Andrew Hickey, who writes and produces his own amazing podcast, and you should definitely listen to The History of Rock Music and 500 Songs. Here's what he says. If you've enjoyed the show, please tell just one person that you like this podcast. Word of mouth, more than any other form of promotion, is how creative works get noticed and sustain themselves. Amen to that. Thank you, Andrew. I love those words. That's what we're going to do. All right. 2025. We're ready. We're all going to get through you together. Heart to heart and hand in hand like a bunch of little who's in Whoville. God, Tess Feifel, man. All right. Here we go. The Other Side by Bishop James A. Pike with Diane Kennedy. Part 1. Like all the best stories about contact from beyond the grave, The Other Side, Doubleday & Company, Garden City, New York, 1968, is about grief. But it's also about curiosity and questioning and the scary things that can happen when your own personal experiences take you beyond the walled garden of your beliefs. The Other Side is the account of the Episcopal Bishop of California, James A. Pike, and his experiences in the roughly 2 years following the suicide of his 20-year-old son, Jim. Within 3 weeks of his son's death, Pike, along with two colleagues, David Barr and Marin Bergrud, began to experience psychic phenomenon, including a range of poltergeist activity, and what can only be called a kind of benign possession during which Bishop Pike himself seemed to psychically display the emotions and words of his deceased son. Pike's search for an explanation of these phenomena led to multiple sittings with various mediums. These sittings, plus his own research into the field of parapsychology, led to Pike's belief that his son's personality had survived death and that they had actually communicated across the veil. So, of course, this pissed off everyone. The Episcopal Church, the media, even the debunkers. The fun thing about Pike is that he truly did not give a whopping shit about any of this. In fact, it's not even the first time he was in hot water with the church. Pike was already a controversial figure when these events occurred and was, in fact, already being charged with heresy. The heresy charges had to do with Pike's extremely liberal views. In keeping with the emerging issues of the time, the 1960s, Pike was firmly and loudly in support of civil rights, gay rights, women's rights, and birth control. He ordained a woman as a First Order deacon and invited the Reverend Martin Luther King Jr. to speak at Grace Cathedral in San Francisco in 1965 following his march to Selma, Alabama. So yeah, Pike was a real pain in the church's ass. Pike also publicly questioned basic doctrine, including the virginity of Mary and the existence of hell and the Holy Trinity. He wasn't trying to tear the church down. He was trying to figure it out, figure out the limits of his own beliefs, and share that internal struggle with the world, who he assumed was struggling right along with him. I love Pike's writing. It is measured and precise, thoughtful. But inside the man there was recklessness. And that is not something you typically associate with a bishop. In America in the 1980s, there was this thing called the moral majority, which turned out to be neither, but at the time its mouthpiece, Jerry Falwell Sr. and Pat Robertson, were considered credible voices of religious authority. Down with sex, down with birth control, down with the gays and women and rock music. So of course, me and all my friends hated them. In Bishop Pike, I found a religious leader to admire because he wasn't judging, he was searching. He was telling us what he found and taking his lumps and not holding himself up as some sort of paragon of moral virtue, because we all know how that goes. His bosses all wanted him to shut up. They thought he was a troublemaker, and they were right. To me, Bishop Pike was Carl Kolchak in choir dress. Pike attacked his personal studies and research with the probing, argumentative mind of a lawyer. And there was a good reason for this. He was a lawyer, and he seemed to view his faith from the perspective of, if I can prove what happened in the Bible, then I can believe it. And so can everyone else. For instance, he grapples with the notion that the Last Supper took place on a Thursday night, making all the events that happened between then and the Friday crucifixion a tight squeeze. When a French Roman Catholic scholar, Annie Joubert, proposed using the Essene calendar instead of the official Jewish calendar to discern the date of the Seder that year, and comes up with Tuesday rather than Thursday, Pike is so relieved. His faith lives on to fight another day. Now, this may seem like a niggling point. I mean, what could the whole Tuesday-Thursday question have to do with a genuine belief in life after death? For Pike, it means everything. He referred to this as his fact plus faith method, a way of grounding his faith in the historical origins of Christianity. Nothing was to be taken for granted. This fact-forward method of dealing with areas of faith helps us understand Pike's approach to the notion of communicating with the dead through a medium. And in this instance, the stakes are so much higher, because now it's about his son. And there was so much unresolved between them at the time of his son's death, so many facts not known about what exactly happened the night he died, that for Pike, there was no room for error. But let's start at the beginning. It's late summer, 1965. Pike has been Bishop of California for almost 8 years by now. But more to our point, he's the father of four children, the eldest of which is his troubled son, Jim. It's hard to read about a time and a place that's been so over-portrayed as San Francisco in the 1960s, especially when it comes to young people living in Haight-Ashbury. But Pike talks about his son's depression, alienation, and experimentation with marijuana and LSD with an immediacy that anyone who's ever had a kid will recognize. He knows he can't be judgmental. He tries to keep lines of communication open. But really, he just wants his kid to stop doing drugs and find a healthy, non-narcotic way to be happy. When a sabbatical post at Cambridge University comes up, Pike asks his son Jim to go with him. Maybe a change of scenery will do him good. And to his surprise, Jim agrees. For the next 5 months, James and Jim live as roommates in a flat in Cambridge. And it's during this time that they grow closer than they've ever been. Jim doesn't give up drugs. Hey, it turns out they have them in England too. And Pike even ends up as an impromptu sober guide a few times when Jim drops acid in their apartment. These are not easy times for Pike. He doesn't love seeing his son strung out and struggling through bad trips. But even in this, Pike holds on to the fact that at least he's able to be there for his son when his son needs him. He tries to learn what's really troubling his kid, why Jim is leaning so hard on the escape the drugs give him, even when that escape is off into a world even more frightening and undependable than our own. Now, it may be hindsight, but as he writes about these 5 months, you can feel Pike's gratefulness for this time together. And of course, we know it won't last. We know what's coming. And when it does, it's excruciating. They leave England in early February of 1966 for a brief visit home. At this time, Pike feels like he's made real progress with Jim. He's not naive enough to think that the drug use is over, but at least their relationship is solid, and maybe better times lie ahead. Pike flies home to San Francisco. Jim stops over in New York to visit friends. Sometime in the next few days, Jim takes a large dose of Romalar cough medicine, along with other unknown substances, has an extremely bad reaction, and ends up killing himself with a single rifle shot to the head in his New York hotel room on February 4th, 1966. 3 weeks later, Pike returns to the Cambridge apartment to begin the grim business of closing it down. And that's when the haunting starts. The Other Side was a book given to me by my girlfriend Michelle Goodwin's dad a few nights before she left for Yale. "Read this," he said. "It's incredible, but it's not for everyone." Despite his recommendation and my desire to cement a relationship with everyone in Michelle's family, the book sat on my desk unread for weeks. The reason for this was simple. I was dead. Sure, I walked around and ate and slept and talked to people, but none of it felt real. My life, my real life, had moved to New Haven, Connecticut. Michelle was starting her first week at Yale. Me, I was just taking up space and breathing thin air and counting the days until winter break when she would come back. Today was Tuesday, September 6th, my first day of senior year. Michelle would not return until December 23rd, 3.5 months. An unimaginable amount of time when you're 16 and miserable. Maybe at any age when you're miserable. 107 days, and each one of them was aching and endless. She'd already been gone more than a week, and my life had divided itself into two halves. Every moment I had lived up until the moment she left, and every moment after, and the second half was by far the longest. There was a feeling taking form inside of me. It was barely noticeable, and I could not have put a name to it, but it was there, and it was growing. Much later in life, I came to recognize it as the feeling that followed the desolation of abandonment. It was a buzzy sort of manic energy. It was desperation. Michelle and I wrote to each other every single day. I know this sounds hopelessly quaint, almost Victorian, but again, it was 1983. Letters were pretty much all we had. Letters every day and a phone call on Sunday nights. I saved those letters. I still have them. And for the record, I spent the last week rereading all of them preparing for this episode, more than 100 letters. God, the things I do for you guys. So, what did I learn? Well, I learned that we both missed each other terribly and loved each other hopelessly and couldn't see how we'd make it through the next 3 months. But as I read those letters, I also got a whole new look at myself. On the outside, I appeared to be a confident, sane, mature 16-year-old. On the inside, I was MacArthur's Park melting in the dark. I was falling apart. The solution? Make the outside guy so solid and real that the inside guy disappeared. Michelle lived in a thing called Trumbull Hall and had four suitemates. They didn't call them roommates, they called them suitemates. It's a Yale thing. And apparently there was a pizza place just off campus she was very excited about called Sally's. It was a New Haven tradition. And the cool thing about Sally's, you had to wait outside for like 2 hours to get your pizza. Oh wait, it's not called that. A beats, that's how you say it. A beats. And guess what? Apparently it was the best a beats in the world. The best she'd ever had. Why was it so good, I asked? Well, as it turned out, there was no way to put it into words. It was just the best. Full stop. You just had to be there. And I wasn't. God, I hated Sally's. But it wasn't all fun and games for her. The classes were hard. Harder than anything she'd ever faced. And it was tough to suddenly be in a group of kids that were all the number one student at their own high schools. And now, what were they here? They were people getting B's and C's, or even worse, failing, for the first time in their whole lives. The pressure to achieve was huge, and it was agonizing because just surviving felt almost impossible. She was in a pressure cooker, and it scared me because, A, I cared about her, and I knew she was suffering in an extra way, which I was not, and B, I knew that pressure cookers had built-in pressure release systems. How would all that pressure release? I didn't want to think about it. The haunting of Bishop Pike started with postcards. He found two of them lying on the floor between the beds in his room. On this visit to England, Pike was accompanied by his chaplain, David Barr, and his assistant, Maren Bergrud. These were longtime friends and colleagues, and Pike trusted them implicitly, especially now, on what was such an emotionally grueling journey, emptying the flat he just shared with his now-dead son for the past 6 months. Pike called David and Maren into the room and pointed to the oddly arranged postcards. "Are these yours?" he asked. They weren't. Besides, the three of them had just entered the locked flat. The cleaning woman had been in, and as it turned out, the postcards didn't belong to her either. And she insisted they had not been there when she finished her work earlier that day. Jim had a habit of buying postcards immediately on a trip, so the weird event made Pike think of Jim. But then he was already thinking about him, and how the last time he'd been in the flat, they'd been there together. And now he was here to close it up without him. The next morning, Maren woke up to find that her bangs had been burned off. A clean, square chunk of hair, blackened along the edges, just gone. The next morning, it happened again. More hair burned off in a straight line, with no burns on her skin or any sign of how or why it was done, except for Pike remembering that Jim had never liked her bangs and had told her more than once, "You should cut them off." The next day, Maren had a strange story to tell. She'd gone into Pike's room to retrieve a book after he'd fallen asleep, but he suddenly woke up, sat up in the bed, and began delivering a loud speech, a speech that didn't sound like him at all. But when she recounted what he'd said, Pike, who had absolutely no memory of this incident at all, realized that it sounded exactly like Jim. Jim often complained that he had a hard time getting close to people, and it was a fear of being hurt that stopped him. He felt he'd been hurt in the past by girls and was trying to build up emotional armor to protect himself. But the end result was that he felt walled off from other people and couldn't connect. Here's what Marin heard through Pike's mouth that night. Quote, "Caring about people is a mistake. You can't count on anybody, and I certainly don't want anybody counting on me. In fact, they can't. The only thing that matters is getting what one wants for oneself. If that involves using people, okay. I just as soon not, but sometimes it's the only way to have things work out the way you want them to. It's better to be hard than soft. You can't get hurt that way. Principles should serve pragmatics. Look out for number one. That's the only policy." The next day, more poltergeist activity, if that's what it was. Two books on the floor between the two beds in the exact position of the postcards from before. And the closet. One side was completely trashed, clothes strewn to the floor in a pile, but the other side, everything neatly in place, more orderly than Pike had ever left it. One side worse than usual, the other side better. It would appear the bishop has a ghost. And if that's not a BBC comedy from the 1960s, then Dudley Moore and Peter Cook have a lot to answer for. Pike confided about these events to a friend, Canon John Pierce Higgins, who suggested a visit to a medium might be in order. And Pike, without hesitation, agreed. Look, Bishop Pike had done everything he could to make a meaningful connection to his son in the months before Jim committed suicide. But much was left unresolved, and all of this weird psychic phenomena had the effect of convincing Pike that the energy behind it could be his son trying to continue their late-night rap sessions. And who could blame him? As crazy and heretical as it sounded, if you were a father who was separated from your child at a time of crisis, wouldn't you do anything, to respond if you thought they were lost in the dark and somehow reaching out to you for help? With Michelle gone, my weekends were unclaimed, so I ended up hanging out with Tim and Larry and Herb in various combinations, but often it was just Larry and me at his house eating cheeseburgers and chili fries from the Hat and watching movies on VHS that we rented from a liquor store down on Garfield Avenue. Tonight, it was Dirty Harry and One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. "How you holding up, Squinchio?" I knew he was talking about Michelle being gone. "I don't know. It's hard," I said. "I'll bet it is," he said. I confided to Larry that I was worried she was out every weekend getting drunk and sleeping with other guys. "Well, why don't you get drunk and go sleep with other guys?" "I know, but back then it was considered funny to pretend to get someone's sexual orientation wrong, if you were straight." What he meant was, of course, why don't I get drunk and go sleep with whoever I wanted to? It annoyed me that he thought it would be as easy as that. Larry was the funniest guy I knew, and we'd been friends since we met the previous year at a drama club meeting. He'd just been cast as Dr. Bradley in The Man Who Came to Dinner, but what no one knew at this point was that while Larry was a sweet guy, a big bear of a kid, his sense of humor was, well, I'll give you an example. At that meeting, the drama club president was explaining our spring fundraiser. The idea was that for $1, you could hire one of the drama kids to deliver an in-person singing telegram to anyone on campus, students, teachers, administrators, whoever. Out of nowhere, Larry pipes up, "Telegrams? What do you mean, like, la la la, your son is dead?" I laughed so hard I almost threw up. That's how we met. And our friendship proceeded like that, both of us seeing how outrageous we could be, how far into the bounds of tastelessness we could take a joke to crack each other up. This kind of humor worked very well for Larry because he looked like a big, friendly teddy bear. So when the knife came out, you got a lot of bang for your comedy buck. If you've ever seen Shaun of the Dead, just picture me as Simon Pegg and Larry as Nick Frost, and you've got a fairly decent idea of our dynamic. Larry was a big guy, 300 pounds, and that was in high school. It's fluctuated over the decades that we've been friends, but never that much. It's not something we've ever really talked about. When we both did stand-up back in our 20s, he surprised me by doing a handful of fat jokes. Like, quote, "I'm on a diet. Actually, I'm on two diets. One diet doesn't give me enough food. When I go to Vaughn's, the manager asks me, 'Shall we wrap up the store, Mr. Gonzalez, or would you like to eat it here?'" These are pretty funny, but then, right there on stage, he veered closer to an emotional truth than I'd ever heard before. "Yeah, that's right. I'm doing fat jokes. Why not? Just trying to make you comfortable. All you skinny people can relax now. Look at the jolly fat man. See, he can laugh at himself." Meanwhile, the fat people in the audience are pretending to laugh, and inside they're going, "Oh God, I hope they're not looking at me." Larry was a Beatles fan and an expert on their music. He knew every musician who played on every track on every album. But this knowledge wasn't just confined to the Beatles. The Beach Boys, the Rolling Stones, Crosby, Stills, and Nash, and Young, David Bowie, the Love and Spoonful, even the Monkees. Larry loved it all, as long as it was recorded before the day I met him. Anything from 1980 onward just didn't interest him. He knew it existed, he just didn't care. Because of Larry, my favorite David Bowie song is a live version of Breaking Glass, because he blasted it relentlessly throughout my junior year. We'd cruise around in his mom's yellow 1973 Datsun 510 station wagon, and he would play music I'd never heard but was slowly learning to love. And he'd crank up the volume so high, I'd have to scream at him, "Can you please turn it up a little? I can still hear some other sounds." And somehow, he'd turn it up even louder. Another thing you should know about me and Larry is that we were huge Three Stooges fans, still are. We'd go to the all-day film festivals at the Rialto in South Pasadena, where they'd show even the really early shorts when the Stooges were still with Ted Healy. We always thought it was hilarious that Mo was sort of framed as the smart stooge, even when they were all equally moronic. Larry had entire routines memorized, and pretty soon I joined in. He was always Curly, I was always Mo. Ironically, there was no Larry. Anyway, that night at Larry's house, I told him everything. How horrible and lonely and completely abandoned I felt. It was easy to confide in Larry because, emotionally, he was completely carved up. Unlike a lot of my friends, there were no layers of complicated emotional masks and facades. With him, it was a matter of what you see is what you get. In short, I didn't have to worry that he'd fuck with me. Which is to say, I knew for a fact that he would fuck with me, but then when the formalities were dispensed with, he would give me his real thoughts and feelings from the heart. And his real feelings were, "Michelle is a good person. She's not going to do you dirty. And if worst comes to worst and something does happen, she'll tell you. So stop worrying." For my part, the idea of getting with another girl felt remote and strangely unappealing. I remember feeling like I wanted it to happen, but only in a general way. Like if some girl absolutely demanded sex from me, that would be cool, but I couldn't picture myself actively pursuing it because deep down, I knew it wouldn't really make me feel any better. The idea of getting drunk was also problematic. I had always struggled so hard to be in control of my life that the idea of being out of control held no appeal. Plus, it was something that other kids did, and I wasn't like other kids. I was better than them. So why do what they were doing? The following week, I changed my mind. Tim, Herb, Larry, and I were all at Robin's, a restaurant way up on Rosemead, north of Foothill. Ironically, we had just seen Strange Brew, the Bob and Doug McKenzie movie, you know, with Rick Moranis and Dave Thomas. They did for beer what Cheech and Chong did for weed. I felt very left out of the joke. So the subject turned to getting me drunk. Tim said it was something I should do just to understand what Michelle was supposedly doing at Yale. "It is what normal people do," he said. "You should try it. You're a writer. Think of it as research." And strangely enough, this argument worked. I wouldn't be drinking to get stupid. I'd be drinking to get smart. Larry offered up his house. His parents were going to be out of town the following weekend. So I agreed to the experiment, but only under the most controlled conditions. Tim would have to pick me up and drive me home. And I would decide exactly how much I drank and when I wanted to stop. The following Friday night, Tim picked me up in his light blue 1973 Plymouth Duster at exactly 7 p.m. My parents liked him because he was a clean-cut kid and spoke right up like an adult. One of the reasons for this was that he was an adult. He was 23. "Hello, Mr. and Mrs. Haddam. I'm taking your son Richard out to get drunk." My mom was charmed. "Good," she said. "Thank you, Tim. Have fun." At Larry's house, Tim unveiled the cocktail choice for the evening. Gin and tonics, his favorite. Of course, tonight he wouldn't be drinking. By my request, no one would, except for me. That way they could observe me and report back on what happened if I blacked out. Tim's advice was as follows. Have one drink, drink it at a moderate pace, and wait an hour before having the second one. Sounded like a good idea. I found I wasn't scared. I was excited. Tim made me a gin and tonic with a wedge of lime, which I squeezed into the drink. I tasted it. It wasn't bad. Not at all. In fact, I kind of liked it. I felt sophisticated. We checked our watches. It was 7:25 p.m. The experiment had begun. "How are you feeling?" The voice was coming from somewhere to my left. I looked over. Herb was now in the room. I thought about his words. He was asking a question, and he was apparently asking me. I should answer. "Good," I said. But I wasn't sure if I was feeling good. I was feeling numb and floaty and disconnected from my environment, like I was in a sensory deprivation tank, and everything around me was just some dim shadow of reality playing out far away from me. I checked the clock. It was 7:40. I was actually feeling sad. Something potentially fun was happening, but I was alone. Yeah, I was with my friends, but I wasn't with someone who really loved me. I wanted to be getting drunk with Michelle. "Stop being a baby," I thought. "This is what teenagers do. This is what guys do. This is supposed to be fun. Start having fun." I stood up quickly. "How do I look?" I said. "Do I look drunk? Do I look weird?" Larry said, "You look like a strunz. Sit down." Larry was in his usual spot on the couch directly in front of the TV. We were watching The Last Detail, or at least they were. My mind was drifting. I went into Larry's bathroom and examined my face in the mirror. It looked normal, but it felt like the visual information was taking a long time to get a firm foothold in my brain. I still felt like myself, but now I found myself fighting the alcohol, trying to push through it, push through the fog, and emerge as myself. But I couldn't. Someone knocked on the bathroom door. "You okay in there?" It was Tim. "Yeah, I'm fine." After a moment, he said, "Maybe one's enough for you." He was being extremely nice to me. He wasn't making fun of me or trying to push me. Therefore, I figured I owed it to him and to science to keep drinking as much as I possibly could. Tim was my hero then, and I'd always had the feeling that he respected me. I thought he thought I was talented and funny and that I'd be successful one day. Like he saw something in me. "Unlock the door," he said. "If you fall down, we need to get to you." I unlocked the door and opened it. I looked up at Tim with tears in my eyes and said, "I love you." Tim squinted at me and said, "Yeah, you're done." I was home in bed by 9:30 p.m. Tim told me to drink a big glass of water with 2 aspirin and 2 vitamin C before falling asleep. I said I would, and I did. The next morning, I woke up not feeling hungover at all, but instead feeling a calm sense of satisfaction. I did it, I thought. I got drunk. But by the afternoon, I knew that I hadn't. Not really. Not the way normal kids do. Not the way Yale kids do. They do it after a week of crushingly difficult classes. They do it so they can lower their inhibitions, blow off steam, let loose, and have an excuse to do things they didn't have to take full responsibility for. What must that feel like? To be able to afford a mistake. The following Thursday, I was at Burger Continental on Lake Avenue in Pasadena with Tim and Larry, and an actor friend of ours, Alan Fineman. Alan played the lead last summer in Tim's production of Play It Again, Sam, at the Broadway Playhouse, the little theater behind the San Gabriel Civic Auditorium. Alan was amazing, so funny. He was a cross between Jerry Lewis and Woody Allen, and he was 30, which made him 7 years older than even Tim. He was a really kind, sweet person, but like a lot of actors I've met over the last 40 years, Alan's main characteristic was a deep and abiding need to be loved. He worked a lot, but most of his income came from doing comedy singing telegrams for a company called Live Wires. In Los Angeles in the early 80s, this was definitely a thing. You could hire an actor to crash your party dressed as Elvis, Marilyn Monroe, Humphrey Bogart, Frank Sinatra, the Blues Brothers, or about a dozen other recognizable Hollywood icons. Alan had told us all about it. His main gig was playing Groucho Marx. He'd do a whole routine and joke around with a guest of honor and sing a song and then get lost. The whole thing took about 15 minutes and cost about $100, but for the rich and famous of LA, it was worth it to spice up your party. Alan made $25 a shot. Not bad for 1983. And sometimes he'd do 5 or 6 a week. That night, he was regaling us with tales of his latest performance at the palatial home of Aaron Spelling. Aaron Spelling was a huge TV producer in the 1970s and 80s. Charlie's Angels, The Love Boat, Fantasy Island, Dynasty, Heart to Heart, Beverly Hills 90210, and many, many more. He was performing at a birthday party for Aaron's 10-year-old daughter, Tori Spelling. After the performance, as he was leaving, Alan walked right up to Aaron Spelling, reached into his coat, and handed him his resume. "This is for you," he said, "if you ever need an actor who can do absolutely anything." Looking at me and Tim, he shrugged. "You never know." Tim laughed it off as the crazy but pointless stunt it probably was. But I was impressed. Alan went on telling us about other celebrities he'd met at the parties where he was hired to perform. B and C listers, but for me, they were all magic. And they were right here in LA, all around us, but somehow separate, anointed. They had made it. We hadn't. Would we ever? We all wanted to so badly, but it all seemed insane and arbitrary. We knew we were talented, or at least we thought we were. Would talent be enough? Or was some wild stroke of luck required? Some uncontrollable element of chance that would either happen or not. We hung out talking for hours that night, but all I could think about was Alan Fineman dressed as Groucho Marx handing Aaron Spelling his resume. What if that's the thing that works? What if that's the story he'll tell years from now on Late Night with David Letterman about the crazy thing he did that changed his life? On the night of Wednesday, March 2nd, 1966, Bishop James Pike heard these words from his dead son. "Dad, remember our discussions of life after death? Well, I guess we settled that one." The words were spoken by Jim through the mouth of Ina Twigg, one of the most perfectly named British mediums ever. The session took place in East Acton, west of London, in a plainly decorated sitting room on the second floor of her house. During the sitting, Jim began by saying, "I failed the test. I can't face you, can't face life. I'm confused. God, I didn't know what I was doing. But when I got here, I found I wasn't such a failure as I thought. I am not in purgatory, but something like hell, here. Yet nobody blames me, here. I hope nobody blames me there." Something like hell. What would it be like to hear your dead child say they're in hell? Jim had a lot on his mind, a lot to convey. "I came to your room, I moved books, I knocked on the door, came to your bedside. You dreamt about me and spoke to me. I've been so unhappy because I didn't have a voice and had to find a way to tell you. I can't believe in God as a person, but I do believe now in eternity. I thought there was a way out. I wanted out. I found there is no way out. I wish I'd stayed to work out my problems in more familiar surroundings. I'm tied to my regrets, yet they're showing me the way out, and we must make progress together." Pike, once he felt comfortable in this strange new mode of conversation, began to engage Jim directly and was struck by how much the back and forth had the feeling of a real conversation with his son. At a certain point, a second voice came through, identified as Paul Tillich, a friend of Pike's who had died the previous year. For a moment, there is confusion as the two spirits struggle for the mic. Finally, Twig has to gently admonish them and ask them to please wait their turn. Pike is struck by the casual evidential proof that Tillich provides, referring to people and events that only the two of them shared knowledge of. But finally, it is Jim who has the last words of the session. "We've all got to grow. Be kind, gentle. Tell Mom I've been back. Give her a kiss from me. And by the way, Dad, there will be no more disturbances now. No more movements." Pike understood this to mean that the poltergeist activity in the apartment would stop. And it did. At least for a while. Pike came away from this session with Ina Twig impressed, but not quite convinced. And this probably describes the way most people feel after this sort of thing. You don't exactly disbelieve, but what do you believe? That the medium wasn't faking? That human consciousness lives on after death? That you were truly speaking to your departed loved one? Pike had briefly felt connected, but then the feeling left him, and in its place came doubt. He knew deep down there was only one way to fix this. He needed to talk to Jim again. An opportunity came 18 months later. It was a sitting with America's most famous psychic medium, and it was broadcast on national television. The Bishop Pike seance that took place on September 3rd, 1967, at the CTV studios in Toronto, Ontario, didn't start out as a debacle, but it got there eventually, even though the full scale of its debacability wasn't fully known for another 6 years. Alan Spraggett, a Canadian journalist who specialized in psychic phenomenon, invited Bishop Pike to be a part of a live, though pre-recorded, trance session with the famous American medium Arthur Ford. Pike agreed to appear on the show because he was on a publicity tour for his new book entitled If This Be Heresy, and the book itself focused on psychic phenomena and the Episcopal Church's current stance on the subject, which boiled down to no bueno. During the first wave of the eventual debacle, Pike claimed that it never occurred to him that participating in a live seance on TV, even in Canada, might bring unwanted attention to his already controversial views on the paranormal. And here, of course, we once again run full force into Pike's greatest strength and tragic flaw. He couldn't keep his mouth shut. For Pike, the whole point of living in contemplation of spiritual issues is to contemplate them out loud, at top volume, in large crowds, and if possible, on television. So here's what happened. Arthur Ford went into a trance, and for the next hour or so, brought through about a half a dozen vague acquaintances of Pike's and provided evidential material regarding cats and ranches and odd personality quirks that had the definite charm of verisimilitude. None of it shed any real light on what happens to us in the afterlife, but it was strangely diverting. Even Pike's son Jim seemed to come through, though not in any more vivid a way than when he spoke through Ina Twigg. By the time it was over, neither Pike nor Spraggett was completely convinced that the seance had been successful. An edited version was broadcast a few weeks later, and it was only then that the American press got wind of it and approached Pike for confirmation that he had contacted his dead son. In the time between the taping and the airing of the seance, Pike had been through a particularly difficult time. He was in the process of being charged with heresy, and the matter had just been resolved in his favor. In fact, big changes had been made in the way the House of Bishops would, in the future, censure one of their own, making the likelihood of an official judgment of heresy extremely unlikely. So, it was just when Pike thought that maybe his controversies were finally behind him that they suddenly jumped up in front of him once again. The public reaction to his remarks regarding whether or not he had truly spoken with the spirit of his son ran the gamut from supportive to really, really unsupportive. The harshest criticism came from within the Christian church, where typically any communication through a medium is considered a hotline to hell. Didn't Bishop Pike know better? Didn't he realize he was being bamboozled by Satan? Pike, of course, was undeterred. He reacted by dissecting the portions of the Bible that seemed to warn against consorting with wizards and mediums, and argued that these admonitions were simply a way for the leaders of early Christianity to distinguish their beliefs from paganism, which was the primary opposing religious model of the time. And this was classic Pike. He never took the bait, but more important, he never conflated the finite human souls he may have encountered in a seance with the infinite soul of the One, capital O. Of course, it didn't matter. People were still pissed. So once again, Pike was in trouble. More trouble than even he was aware of. Because rumors were starting to reach him that Arthur Ford had not only not reached his son Jim during the televised Canadian seance, but that he had faked the entire thing. By October 1st, 1983, I felt like I was losing my mind. I was hard at work on my second A-team script, but it was going slow, and I was getting demoralized. Worse than that, I was getting angry. A second season of the show had just started, and I didn't think the first two episodes were any better than what I was writing. And yet here I was, still going to high school like a jerk when I should be, I don't know, happier, more successful, less frustrated, less miserable, less stuck. Michelle's letters sounded different now. She still said she missed me and loved me, but she was spending more time sharing these feelings with Ken, her RA, and Tom Sines, another Alhambra High School kid who got accepted to Yale at the same time she did. Tom was a guy who had liked Michelle back when she and I started dating. In fact, she had been hoping he would ask her to the senior prom, and it was just by chance that I'd asked her first. She assured me that she was not romantically interested in Ken or Tom, and I believed her, sort of. She also had a French teacher that she apparently thought was very cute. Great. I looked around my bedroom. It felt like a prison cell. More and more, I would find my head throbbing or my stomach hurting. I was starting to have trouble sleeping. Maybe she isn't the only one in a pressure cooker, I thought. Maybe she isn't the only one who needs a release. I came up with a plan. I want to say up front that I thought it was a brilliant plan, and I never seriously questioned it, no matter how weird or insane you might think it is. To me, it made perfect sense. I set the plan into motion on Tuesday, October 11th. Sixth period debate. Mr. Cullen's room was a collection of round tables where students were expected to do their work preparing for debate tournaments. Cullen was our favorite teacher because he didn't care about running his classroom like every other teacher, and he treated us like adults, which meant we took advantage of his trust by goofing off as much as we possibly could. We could have lit a bonfire in the middle of the classroom, and all he'd have done is call us a pack of savages and tell us to put it out. Perfect. Because I needed to use his desk phone, and I didn't want him to know who I was calling or what it was about. And I didn't want there to be any way for anyone to trace this particular phone call back to me. Toward the middle of class, around 2 o'clock, he walked past me and muttered, "Haddam, watch the room. I've got to meet with the principal," which I always assumed meant he was going to the bathroom. The instant the door clicked shut behind him, I was sitting at his desk accessing an outside line and calling the main number for Stephen J. Cannell Productions, which had moved off the Paramount lot and into their own building near the corner of Hollywood Boulevard and La Brea. In fact, Stephen Cannell owned the entire building. His name and logo was on a huge lighted sign on the roof, and at night you could see it miles away. I told whoever it was who answered the phone that I was calling for Stephen Cannell, and he transferred me. A woman who sounded like she worked for the president of Exxon answered, "Stephen J. Cannell's office." I said, "Hi, this is Tim Doyle with Livewire Singing Telegrams. We have someone who's ordered a comedy telegram for Mr. Cannell. When would be the best time to schedule that?" The woman on the other end of the phone took a long pause and then said, "Oh, he would love that. Let me take a look at his schedule." She put me on hold. I looked around the classroom. Absolutely no one was paying any attention to me. She came back on the line. "How is Thursday at 3:30? I thought to myself, well, sixth period ends at 2:25. If Larry has his mom's car that day, he can pick me up and we can be in Hollywood by 3:15 easy. Yes, I said, 3:30 on Thursday will be perfect. She confirmed it, and that was that. I hung up. It had been easier, way easier than I had expected. I felt like the dog that caught the car. Now what? Well, that was obvious. I would go to Stephen Cannell's office at 3:30 on Thursday. I would be dressed as Mo Howard from the Three Stooges. Larry would be dressed as Curly. We'd do a little routine, and then at a key moment, just like Alan Feynman had done with Aaron Spelling, I'd make my move. I'd hand him my A-team script. And then he'd be so charmed and bowled over by my ingenuity, my pure determination and grit, and by the fact that I'd conned my way into his office, just like a character in one of his own TV shows, he'd have no choice but to read my script. And I knew in my soul, once he read it, he'd get it. He'd get me. He would see me and see himself in me. And my life would finally change. I'd become unstuck. More than that, I'd become famous, legendary even. I'd transcend all those Yale boys, and it wouldn't be because I was rich or smart or had the sleek, hairless body of a water polo player. It would be because I was a scrappy TV writer, willing to do anything to make a name for myself. Michelle was an uptown girl now, but I was her downtown man. That's what I am. And if you haven't seen that video in a while, you should definitely check it out. It is delightful. I called Larry. "I did it," I said. "Did what?" he asked. So I told him, "We're going to Stephen J. Cannell's office. We'll do a Three Stooges singing telegram kind of thing. I'll come up with something. But it'll just be us, two stooges. Look, we just need to get into his office long enough for me to give him my script. What do you say?" There was a long silence on the other end of the line. Then Larry chuckled and said, "Okay." And this is why Larry is my best friend. No questions, no pushback. Like this was the most normal thing in the world. Just a laugh and an okay, and he was in. We had 48 hours. Thank you for joining me on Richard Haddam's Paranormal Bookshelf. Please join me next time for The Other Side, Part 2. Richard Haddam's Paranormal Bookshelf is presented by Astonishing Legends, 134 West, and Summerland Entertainment. Executive producers, Scott Philbrook, Forrest Burgess, and Susan Lambert. Our associate producer is Tess Feifel, and our sound designer, engineer, and editor is Kevin Ducey. Artwork is by Tommy Beaver, website is by Kayla Lord, and our music, as always, is by Nima Kazaruni. Until next time, be safe and be well, find the light in the dark, and we'll see you again soon.
You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job post seen on other job sites. With Indeed's sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/kidsandfamily. Just go to Indeed.com/kidsandfamily right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need. You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job posts seen on other job sites. With Indeed sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/kidsandfamily. Just go to Indeed.com/kidsandfamily right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.
You have 5 new messages.
Hey, Carl, it's Jen from Finance. Could you submit your expenses this week?
Hey, Carl, happy Friday. It's Jen, Finance. Just need those receipts today.
Me again, Carl. Really need those receipts, like last week. Please just tell me where they are. Are you by your desk right now?
Finance teams, you shouldn't be chasing down Carl or anyone else. With Ramp, expenses are sent with a text and reminders happen automatically. Switch your business to ramp.com today and love finance again.